Okay, so we're diving deep today into some Texas legal cases.
Right.
And you know what I find really interesting about these is they both involve the same guy, John Nolan Jr., but they show us like two totally different sides of appellate review in action.
Yeah, it's like a two-for-one legal masterclass, right?
Exactly. One case is all about community supervision revocation and, you know, that whole due process thing. And then the other one takes us into the world of an unsigned jury charge and a drug delivery conviction. Oh, and there are some clerical errors sprinkled in too, just to keep things spicy.
I love those clerical errors. Always keeps things interesting.
So our mission today, if you're up for it, is to break down these cases, figure out why they matter, like what are the real-world implications of these legal nuances,
Yeah.
especially for folks interested in the legal system.
Right, because these things happen more often than you might think.
And maybe uncover a legal twist or two along the way. You never know what we'll find.
Always up for a good legal twist.
So let's jump right into that first case, the community supervision one. Our sources tell us that Nolan was on deferred adjudication for violating a protective order. And not just once, but repeatedly.
Oh, wow. So this wasn't his first rodeo?
Definitely not.
Yeah.
Now, for those who might not be familiar with Texas law, deferred adjudication is kind of like probation.
Yeah, it's a chance to avoid a final conviction on your record.
Right.
Good
Exactly.
throw.
If you successfully complete all the terms and conditions, then boom, it's like that offense never even happened.
But there's a catch, right?
Oh, there's always a catch.
If you slip up, violate the terms of your deferred adjudication, the state can move to revoke it. And then things get a lot more serious.
And that's exactly what happened with Nolan. The state alleged she committed seven different violations, and they decided it was time to pull the plug on his deferred adjudication.
Seven violations. That's a lot.
It is. And at the hearing, Nolan, he admitted to some of them, but definitely not all.
Oh, he's acknowledging some missteps, but fighting others.
Exactly. And this is where things get really interesting. Despite those partial admissions, the trial court decided to find all seven violations true, revoked his community supervision, and sentenced him to 10 years behind bars.
Whoa, 10 years. That's a hefty consequence,
Yeah.
especially considering he was on deferred adjudication for the original offense. So not even a formal conviction yet.
Right, it's a big jump. And that kind of outcome makes you wonder, was that really fair? Was the process leading up to that decision fair and impartial?
Yeah, that's a valid question.
And that's exactly what Nolan argued in his appeal. He claimed his due process rights were violated. Specifically, he said the trial court didn't give him a separate written statement explaining the evidence they used and the reasons for revoking his supervision.
Ah, the good old due process argument, a cornerstone of our legal system.
And this argument has some serious weight behind it. It's rooted in landmark Supreme Court cases like Morrissey v. Brewer and Gagnon v. Scarpelli.
Yeah, those are big ones.
Huge! They establish that even in parole or probation revocation hearings, individuals still have certain basic due process rights.
Because even though it's not a full-blown criminal trial, you're still talking about a significant loss of liberty.
Right, exactly. Getting your probation or parole revoked and ending up in prison, that's a huge deal. And the courts have said there need to be some safeguards in place to make sure it's not done arbitrarily or unfairly.
And one of those safeguards is often interpreted as requiring written findings from the court.
Exactly. Having those reasons written down makes the process more transparent and allows for meaningful appellate review.
Otherwise, it's like trying to appeal a decision when you don't even know why it was made in the first place.
Exactly. But here's the thing. In this case, the Texas Court of Appeals, they didn't side with Nolan. They upheld the trial court's decision.
So what was their reasoning there?
Well, our sources point to three main reasons. The first one, and this is crucial for anyone listening who's involved in the legal world, Nolan's lawyer didn't object to the lack of a separate written statement at the trial level.
Ah, that's a classic appellate procedure hurdle.
Yeah.
You've got to raise those objections at the trial court level.
Right, you have to give the trial court a chance to fix any errors while the case is still in front of them.
Otherwise, the appellate court is going to say, hey, you had your chance. Why did you speak up then?
Exactly. It's all about fairness to both sides and making the process as efficient as possible.
Makes sense.
Now, the second reason the appellate court wasn't persuaded was because they felt the existing record was clear enough to understand why the trial court made their decision.
So even without that separate document, they thought the reasoning was there.
Right. They pointed out that the state's motion to revoke listed all seven violations.
That's a good starting point.
And the trial judge actually read each one out loud during the hearing.
Okay, so the information was definitely presented.
And the final written judgment referenced all seven paragraphs from that original motion, too.
So it sounds like they took a more pragmatic approach, looking at the whole picture, rather than just focusing on that one missing document.
Exactly. And our sources even found a previous Texas case, Henderson v. State, which supports this idea.
Oh, so there's precedent for this kind of thinking.
Yep. Henderson basically suggests that if the appellate court can clearly figure out the trial court's reasoning from everything in the record, then a separate formal written explanation might not always be strictly necessary.
Interesting. So it's like a we get the gist standard.
Right. Yeah. Especially if no one objected at the time.
So what's the big takeaway from this first case?
I think the main point here is that Texas appellate courts, while they're definitely concerned with due process, they're also going to look at the big picture.
They're not sticklers for every little formality.
Right. If the reasons behind the trial court's decision are clear from all the evidence and nobody objected at the time, then they might not insist on every single procedural I being dotted and famed across.
You absolutely have to object to any errors you see during the trial itself. If you don't, those arguments might be dead on arrival at the appellate level.
Dead on arrival. No chance of revival.
It really shows how important it is to have a good lawyer who knows the rules and isn't afraid to speak up when something seems off.
Couldn't agree more. All right, let's shift gears and dive into case number two. This one involves a conviction for delivering a pretty significant amount of cocaine, between 4 and 200 grams to be exact. And the jury slapped Nolan with a 50-year sentence.
50 years. That's a long time.
It is. And this case takes a turn because the trial court made a pretty big procedural error. The punishment jury charge, you know, the instructions the jury gets to help them decide on the sentence, it wasn't signed by the judge.
Oh, wow. That's a pretty basic but important step. Yeah. The judge's signature on the jury charge is like their stamp of approval.
Right. It's them saying, these are the official instructions.
And to make matters even more interesting, there were some clerical errors in the final judgment, too.
Oh, yeah. We can't forget about those. Little details can make a big difference sometimes.
For sure. So how did things play out from there?
Well, as you might imagine, Nolan appealed again. This time, he argued that the unsigned jury charge was a reversible error, you know, serious enough to overturn the whole conviction.
I mean, it does seem like a pretty big oversight.
Right. And he also claimed that his trial lawyer didn't do a good enough job basically alleging ineffective assistance of counsel.
Ah, the classic 1-2 punch of appellate arguments.
And it makes sense, right? These are some of the most common grounds for appeal in criminal cases because they get to the heart of whether someone got a fair trial.
Yeah. If the jury's working with flawed instructions or if your lawyer isn't up to par, that could definitely affect the outcome.
Absolutely. So our sources tell us that according to Texas law specifically, Article 36.14 of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, an unsigned jury charge is a definite no-no. It's considered a procedural error.
So Nolan's got a point there.
He does. The law is pretty clear that the judge has to authenticate that charge with their signature.
It's all about making sure the jury is using the right legal framework, the one the judge has approved.
Right. But here's the catch. Just because there was an error doesn't automatically mean the conviction gets thrown out.
There's got to be more to it than that.
Exactly. In Nolan's case, the appellate court used what's called the harmless error test. It comes from a case called Almanza v. State. And this test basically asks, did that error actually influence the jury's decision?
Makes sense. So they're not just looking at whether there was a mistake, yeah, but whether that mistake really mattered.
Right. And in Nolan's case, the court considered a few things. First, even though the written charge wasn't signed, the judge did read the whole thing out loud to the jury in open court.
Okay, so the jury heard the correct instructions, even if they didn't see the signature on the paper.
Exactly. Second, the appellate court couldn't find any evidence that the missing signature actually had any impact on the 50-year sentence the jury decided on.
So they're looking for a direct link between the error and the outcome. Did that missing signature actually change anything?
Right. And third, just like in the first case, Nolan's lawyer didn't object to the unsigned charge during the trial.
So again, the appellate court's thinking, if it was such a big deal, why didn't you say something then?
Exactly. It makes their argument on appeal a lot weaker.
It's all about preserving those issues for appeal.
So here's the real kicker. Despite that unsigned jury charge, the appellate court decided it was a harmless error under the Almanza test, and they upheld Nolan's conviction.
So even a clear procedural error doesn't automatically mean a new trial.
Nope. The big question is, did that error actually change the results of the case?
It's like they're saying, okay, there was a mistake, but did it really matter in the grand scheme of things?
Exactly. Now, what about those clerical errors in the judgment? Our sources say there were a few. The judgment got Nolan's name wrong, the specific offense was wrong, and even the length of his punishment was wrong.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of mistakes on one document.
It is.
Yeah.
But the appellate court had a solution. They decided to reform the judgment.
So they basically fixed the paperwork.
Exactly. Appellate courts have the power to do that when the correct information is obvious from other parts of the record, like the jury's verdict or the court transcript.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
You're just making sure the official records match what actually happened.
Right. No need to send the whole case back to the trial court for a do-over.
Saves everyone time and money.
Exactly. Efficiency is key. Okay, lastly, let's talk about Nolan's ineffective assistance of counsel claim. He argued that his lawyer messed up by not requesting discovery about a messed up DPS report.
Ah, so he's saying his lawyer should have dug deeper.
Right. But when the appellate court looked at the trial record, they found something interesting in the up. Nolan's lawyer actually used the errors in that same DPS report to cross-examine witnesses during the trial.
Oh, so he used it to his advantage.
Exactly. Which totally undermines the argument that he should have requested more information about it.
Yeah, if he already had enough to use it in court, then it's hard to say he needed more.
And this is important because to prove ineffective assistance of counsel, you have to show two things. One, that your lawyer's performance was below par. Like, a decent lawyer wouldn't have done that.
Right. It's got to be more than just a difference in opinion or strategy.
Exactly. And two, you have to show that this bad lawyering actually hurt your case. Like, if your lawyer had done their job correctly, the outcome might have been different.
So there has to be real harm done, not just a hypothetical what if.
Right. And in this case, because Nolan's lawyer used the info from the DPS report, the appellate court said, nope, not ineffective assistance of counsel.
It really shows that proving ineffective assistance is tough. You can't just say your lawyer made a mistake. You got to show that mistake really messed things up for you.
Couldn't have said it better myself. So wrapping up the second case, what are the key takeaways?
Well, first, we see how important that harmless error analysis is. Even if there's a mistake, the appellate court's going to focus on whether it actually changed the outcome of the case.
Right. And we also see that appellate courts can fix those little clerical errors to make sure the court records are accurate.
It's all about keeping things tidy.
And finally, that whole ineffective assistance of counsel argument. It's a high bar to clear. You have to show both a serious error by your lawyer and that it actually hurt your case.
It's not enough to just point fingers. You gotta prove it made a real difference.
So taking a step back and looking at both of these cases involving John Nolan Jr., we've gotten a glimpse into the world of appellate review in Texas.
Yeah, we've seen how they handle due process concerns in community supervision revocations and how they scrutinize procedural errors in trials.
And what's really fascinating is how these two separate legal battles, both involving the same guy, highlight the different ways appellate courts approach things depending on the type of error and the stage of the legal process.
It's like comparing apples and oranges.
In one case, it's all about fundamental fairness in a revocation hearing,
making sure everyone's rights are protected.
And in the other, it's about the technicalities of a jury charge and making sure the court records are correct.
Two different sides of the same coin.
So this really makes you think, how do these cases shape your understanding of all the checks and balances within our legal system? What stands out to you about how they handle these different scenarios?
For me, it's that balance between procedural rules and achieving justice.
Right. They want to make sure things are done by the book, but they're also focused on whether the outcome was fair.
And that's the real heart of appellate review.
It is. And here's something else to consider. Even when there's a big procedural error, like that unsigned jury charge, the appellate court still zeroed in on how it might have affected the verdict.
It didn't just throw out the conviction because of a technicality.
Right. And that balancing act between following the rules perfectly and making sure the result is fair, that's a fundamental part of appellate law.
It really makes you think about when those rules are absolutely crucial and when the focus should be on whether the process, despite a few hiccups, still led to a just result.
A lot to ponder, right?
Definitely food for thought for anyone interested in law.
Absolutely. All right, that wraps up our deep dive for today. Until next time.
See you then.